great committee, and I appreciate you asking to be on it. And you're sitting next to some real stars there, so.
Oh,
yeah. Cool.
That's you. Competition stuff here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. I'm happy to be here.
Stars are over
we
here,
do
Madam.
Really good work in this committee, and I think you'll enjoy our thoughtful approach to this energy committee. We have a lot of responsibility here, so we're doing good things in a very bipartisan way, too, so it's very nice. We have two bills on the agenda today, and before we start, I just want to mention that on Thursday, we have this room till 5:30. Hopefully, we won't have to go into the hours. We do have this from 6 to 7:30 also, but hopefully we don't have to go too late. We are going to do the Senate File 1205, which is the Renewable Development Fund legislation. We're going to process Senator Benson's Conservation Improvement Bill. And then we've got the omnibus bill to vote on. So that's our Thursday agenda. But for right now, we've got Senate File 1093, Senator Benson. Are you okay with starting with 1093?
Thank you.
And before we start, members, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have Senate File 1093 and we also have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment. I'd like to move that at this time.
A2 has not been passed out yet. We have the A3 and the A4. We have the A2.
A2 is in the packet.
Is it in our packets?
Yep.
Senator Benson. Something here, guys.
And the A2 amendment just makes small wording changes that reporting should be done based on wholesale and retail utility pricing.
Okay, we need to get. Does everybody have this?
Mm-hmm.
Does everyone have the A2? Oh, just the chair didn't have it. Sorry. Okay, we're good.
Not
all right,
good
Senator Benson moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion on the A2? Any discussion, Senator Vance? What does it do again for the person that's been
As part of the larger bill, we're looking at costs of rates, and this would require them to differentiate between wholesale and utility. Or I'm sorry, wholesale and retail sales.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, are those the only two entities involved? And the reason I ask is that it seems logical, you know, you have wholesale power generators or retail establishments that the local power companies, but some person contacted me about, and I'm somewhat familiar with it, and that's it's called the Northern Municipal Power Agency. It's a group of cities in northwestern Minnesota that really are not wholesale generators and they're not retail generators. But yet they are, so I'm wondering how would they be impacted? What would they, and that actually does apply, I think, to the overall legislation too, is that, I'm not asking that as a question so much because I think maybe as we get some testimony, we can maybe get that clarified. But I just wanted to say that that has been brought up to me about that issue.
Mm-hmm. Senator Benz, also Mr. Fuller would like to respond to that question.
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, this bill builds on the renewable energy standard. And so under that law, electric utility is a defined entity, and they are the generation and transmission entities and the investor-owned ones. So to the extent if this entity that you're talking about is subject to the RES, which either it is or it isn't, I think it might be, but if then they would be subject to this requirement, and they'd either make wholesale or retail sales. So I don't think there's an issue. So we're building on the renewable energy standard law. Your local co-ops, for instance, are not subject to that. It's the parent company that is. So it's those folks who are going to be reporting on the cost of their compliance and the impact on the rates.
Senator Stump?
Right. I'll maybe listen to some more testimony as we go. So thanks.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, I'm Bill Black from the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. The Northern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency files its integrated resource plans jointly with Minn Kota Power, and so together they would be under the same obligation together for this reporting. And so I've talked with the NMPA director about this issue too, and he seems to be okay with the change made here. It wouldn't create any more requirement on NMPA than on anyone else. And they would still be a wholesaler the way that the RES looks at them.
Okay.
So. Further questions on the A2 amendment? Anybody else like to testify? All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Amendment does pass. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1093 is designed to help us understand the economic impact of our renewable energy policy. It is not to undermine our renewable energy policy. It is to bring us more information so that we can make good decisions about energy policy going forward. We've had some of these standards in place for a time, and we've all gotten comfortable with where they're at. Let's glean the knowledge that's out there, the knowledge that's available, and use that to make good decisions going forward. That's the purpose of this amendment, and I'm going to ask Bride Seifert from the Chamber to come up and address this in more detail.
Welcome, Ms. Seifert.
Madam Chair, committee members, Bride Seifert, Manager of Energy Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber and our several thousand members are asking your support on this important bill. We've heard from some people that renewables are the least cost resource, and others say they're the most expensive thing in the world. All we're trying to do is get the utilities to give us the answer to that question. It's just a what is this cost bill? The same thing goes not only for the cost of the RES, but whether we should make it bigger, whether we should roll it back, things like that. This bill answers no matter what your beliefs are on the renewable energy standard. It answers everyone the same way. Again, let's just get some costs. We've had some questions on how this would work. We've talked to the utilities, both the munis, the co-ops, and the investor-owned utilities. They've agreed to a stakeholder process so that the assumptions that go into the reports would be the same, so you wouldn't have multiple different reports with lots of different information in it. And the intent is to capture the net cost of the renewable energy standard. So it wouldn't just be like, oh, well, it cost us this much to add wind, and wouldn't consider the cost of what they would have paid for coal or nuclear if it didn't exist. So it really is a very, we know that there would be costs for other generation. We'll factor that in there as well. And the requested information does, the stakeholder process will determine exactly what goes in there, whether it's rolling back a coal plant or getting new generation, or if you've got some very good, you know, PPAs from a wind developer. All those costs will be recognized in this report. And from what we've heard is that the numbers are going to be pretty reasonable. So whatever the numbers are, we should know them now or in 150 days, and we should know them going forward. The second part of the bill requires that this gets reported in the integrated resource plans of the utilities. So it's not just a let's look at this one time or one snapshot. It is intended to say, how is this going to change going forward? Is it going to get more expensive? Is it going to get less expensive if, you know, there's a carbon cost or whatever the case may be, if, you know, coal prices go up? There's all sorts of things that indicate a need for future information as well as present information with the RES. And another reason that some of the folks have said that they'd like to support this is the ambiguity of off-ramp language that was included in the 2007 Act. Some folks were very comfortable voting for it because of that, but there's a question because one of the big triggers for that is a cost that might be too high. Without that cost information, there's nothing that would trigger it, I guess, is some people's concern. And again, from what we hear, that's not going to be an issue with this report at all. But it is something that people have talked about as far as the drafting of the original bill. And I'm happy to answer any questions anyone has.
Senator Kuplin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Seifert or Senator Benson, there are a couple of things. Did I hear you say that they would include, the public support for every form of energy out there as a part of how you boil this down? It seems to me that unless we have, the amounts that the varying forms of energy are subsidized by the public, that you're not going to have a valid comparison. And, when you're looking at coal, are we looking at what the EPA is currently doing in drafting new rules for coal plants under court order, I understand, to look at a variety of things, and we don't even know if they're going to be looking at carbon emissions as one of those things at the moment. It may or it may not be, but I mean, if those rules don't come into play until after the study is done, could it be we're missing out on a major piece of what any form of energy might cost us in comparison with any other?
Ms. Seifert.
Madam Chair, Senator Kubley, that's a great question, and I feel like it's a two-part question. The first is that if you compare the energy costs for every generation source, there's pretty long-term information for that. And the reason this only focuses on the RES is because this is the only mandated energy source. Any other source has to be least cost based on the resource process. So the resource planning process. So that's the only reason. This is the only one with a mandate. So this is the only one that people are really questioning. What's it really costing us? And as far as EPA regs that come online or any other substantial change, whether it's a massive economic upswing, which we're hoping for, or new regulation, that's part of what this bill envisions, is that their integration resource plan will be updated with this information every 2 years. And just from preliminary discussions that we've had with the utilities, there are, carbon costs in some estimations right now. So in when you do anything like this, that's something that will be part of the stakeholder process to determine whether you do a zero carbon cost or a $17 or a $34 to get a better range of some possibilities that might exist based on possible regulation coming your way.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering about those pieces. It does seem to me that what the EPA does could change it quite significantly.
Absolutely. Senator Benson, I hate to do this to you, but I have to run off for a hearing on another bill. So Senator Jungbauer is going to take over. But I do have a question. It's probably more of a comment and just to let the committee know that our conversations with Ms. Seifert and you, Senator Benson, I had some angst about this bill, considering that there's push from one side to blow up the RES, which I don't think is very thoughtful and not a very good idea. And then from the other side, it's like, less increasing. We have to be, somewhat reasonable about all this. So I look forward to the results of this, and I hope that there's other people that want to testify perhaps from the environmental community that agree that this is the direction that we should go to make sure that we are getting the correct information about our standards and that we can still continue to move forward. My question is, are there other states that are doing anything like this? I know we've got quite a few states surrounding us that have a substantial renewable, I shouldn't say standard, but have put in a lot of renewables. Have they done any cost comparisons, do you know, Ms. Seifert? Or
Madam Chair, I do not know that answer. I know that the surrounding states, the majority of them, are objectives, which we formerly were, and now we're a mandate. Mm-hmm. So that makes us a little different from them anyways, but I haven't heard of a cost analysis, and I don't think that we've looked into it.
Mm-hmm. But you probably see a lot more states looking into it. I think it is a good prudent thing to do so we can make sure that we're focusing our resources in the right direction, too, on a particular renewable also to see. And my other question, too, Senator Benson or Ms. Seifert, is the information that's going to be required in this report is a lot of this is in the IRP, the Integrated Resource Plan. So the utilities cost of furnishing the service to each customer class, the job and business growth, retention, development of competitive business. I mean, is a lot of that information already in place?
IRP.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. I believe you're talking about a different bill, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on the wrong bill. Sorry. Okay, it's time to go. Get my other bill done here.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. Sorry. So, okay. Sorry. That's okay. Any other questions? I'm going to turn this over to Senator Jungbauer.
Although you hate to do that to
me. I know. No, actually, right now I do.
And Mr. Chair, committee members, I do have one more testifier, Mr. John Rolfe from Medtronic. I'd appreciate if you step forward.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Rolfe. I'm the energy manager at Medtronic. I'm sure you've heard of us. We have quite a large energy bill here in Minnesota. And as the person here in the room who's actually paying the bill and paying for all this stuff, we just want to have transparency. We kind of like to know, you know, where's the money going? How is it being spent? We're not against the RES at all. I think it's a good policy to have, but everything's got limits. So I just want to make that clear. The off-ramp came up. I don't think that's a big issue for us. I don't think we're anywhere near that kind of discussion at this point, at least from Medtronic's point of view. Some of the big users in town maybe have a different approach, but just from Medtronic's point of view, we're not at that kind of level. We're in the $10-20 million type of thing. So at least for Medtronic, we're not even close to a off-ramp discussion. So I don't want to let that scare anybody. We just want to know, everything is about cost these days. What is it costing? Transparency is always good. And we want to know how efficient it is. We might find out that with new EPA rules, we might find out that it's actually going to be cheaper to do more renewables than to get, coal down to the level they need. But without the cost, you can't make a choice one way or the other. So we support the bill, but it's mainly just for transparency. There's no plan in the background to attack the RES. So I just want to make that clear.
Well, thank you, Mr. Rolfe. I think, members, that makes a lot of sense when you hear, I don't know if you guys listen to talk radio, for example, but people use vague terms on both sides of what the cost of something is and never talk about, when you introduce some renewable, for example, they don't talk about what would it be if you scale it up and things like that. So I'm always thinking about those kind of things. If you could do large scale things, does it reduce the cost? And that's the kind of things, that really, I think, relate back to industry. But Mr. Rolfe, having just come back from my Easter vacation in Warsaw, Indiana, the orthopedic capital of America, and seeing your site down there as well, does Medtronic do internally, do you know what your energy costs are in different areas of the United States? Do you guys
absolutely
do those kind of things?
Yes, we've got the database. I can track down any of the Warsaw, Indiana plant. We just did a big lighting retrofit down there. They wanted to add more air conditioning because they got so many lays running right now. They can't keep the building cool. So they were going to add more air conditioning. I said, no. Retrofit your lights. So we spent the money on reducing the lighting load, which saved 20 tons of cooling. So we've got the whole approach on managing a site from an energy point of view. Yeah, we've got all the numbers. You know, we've got New Jersey sites, California, Texas, Minnesota. And, you know, I can tell you the rates and what we're paying in every facility we have.
I'd be very interested in some of that information in terms of what some of the retrofits you've done and what they've saved. I don't know if anybody else would be, but if you could get us some of that information, that'd be great.
I can give you the broad numbers in the Twin Cities. When I came to Medtronic, they didn't really have any metrics in place. And in the last 4 years, we've reduced consumption, not adjusted for revenue or anything, just energy per square foot. We've reduced it 24%, which is pretty significant. Especially in the SIP program, we're talking about 1.5.
Right.
You know, that's...
And you've got documented what you did to decrease that.
Yes.
You know, Senator Dibble, you were really interested in that kind of conservation program. So those kind of things would be nice to, if you like to make any of that public, but it would be nice for some of us to understand as we're going through some of these conversations what.
Yeah, I mean, I can discuss or give you kind of, I won't give you the specifics, but I can give you the types of things we've done and what some of the paybacks were. Okay. They probably wouldn't let me release cost data, but I can, things like lighting and boilers and thermostat control, things like that.
Well, that's great. Any other questions for Mr. Rolfe? Well, thank you. I appreciate that because it tells us and lends to the argument that you know what you're talking about in terms of energy costs and taking care of those and controlling the costs at the building sites. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Howe.
Yeah, I'd have a question as long as we have in front of us here. Where do we rank as far as the different facilities that we have, Minnesota rates? Where are we in that continuum?
In
relation to the actual rates that are recharged per kilowatt?
I would say, well, we're cheaper than the coasts. It's kind of a dish. The coasts are high, Midwest is low, and Texas is lowest. It's kind of how it works out. And there's differences, too, with demand versus energy on how that we're pretty standard here. The coasts are very high on the demand, not so much on the energy. So it's the way they structure it's a little bit different.
I forgot your
McGuire. That's okay.
McGuire. I'll get it.
Nameplate that one.
Yeah, it's no, I don't have a nameplate.
Senator McGuire, yes, you don't have a nameplate, so.
Really,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rolfe, I'm just wondering, since you do business in other states, do they keep, the previous chair, Chair Rosen, was wondering if other states do these compliance reports. Are you familiar with other states that do these compliance reports in the other states that Medtronic does business? And how does it work?
Rolfe.
To Chair, the other states I'm not that familiar with. No. We don't have a concentrated load like we do here in the Twin Cities, so I spend most of my rate and legislative attention here rather than, you know, we've got the one site in Indiana, but it's not worth getting involved at the level for.
Pretty small compared to what you have invested in yeah. Minnesota here.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was just going to mention that even though the demand is high in a place like California, what they have been very successful at is keeping the per capita demand for energy flat, interestingly. People think, oh, California and all their consumer-driven economy and all their toys and gadgets and all their people and et cetera, et cetera. But they've been very, very successful at literally flatlining their per capita demand energy use through a very aggressive and innovative energy efficiency and conservation policy.
Other questions, Senator Benson? Did you have?
Thank you, Mr. Rolfe. If everyone is finished with their questions, I believe we have some amendments.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rolfe.
So I have the A3 and the A4 amendment. I think they've been passed out, which I'm offering for discussion or adoption, depending on the demeanor of the chief author. We don't have to necessarily adopt them today, but Ms. Seifert did mention in her testimony, and let me just say for the record, I support this bill. I think it's a good idea. There's certainly nothing to be feared from and a lot to be desired from, really, understanding the cost data for the renewable energy standard and bringing renewables into our portfolio and our mix, especially with the aggressive schedule that we have in our state. And so really understanding that and using a common metric, apples to apples, and making sure we're measuring all the right things is a good thing. And I think that supports the earlier testimony. So the first amendment, A3, would be inserted in front of energy purchases. So it would be actual and avoided energy purchases. And the argument there is that, while we're certainly spending money to build additional wind and purchasing wind energy, at the same time we're avoiding purchasing some others, from other sources of energy. And so we need to make sure that we're putting the pluses and the minuses in the spreadsheet. So that's the gist of the A3 amendment. The A4 amendment is to make sure that we're measuring costs over the life cycle of a power purchase agreement or the life cycle of a additional generation that a utility itself might own.
Yeah.
Because, there's depreciation that gets factored in. There's certain points of time in which energy costs different prices. And also, if we're throwing on the supporting infrastructure, there's a lot of argument that if we do wind, we'll have to build all this transmission. That's very expensive. But we're also putting, we're building transmission for other purposes as well, to replace aging transmission, to serve emerging communities, to support the transmission of generation from other sources. So the second sentence is about making sure we're allocating costs correctly, attributable to the right sort of thing. So we're just trying to measure more precisely the right things in the right time frame and making sure we're measuring the things we're adding and subtracting the things that need to be subtracted. And so that's the gist of the A3 and the A4 amendments.
Questions, members? Comments? Senator Dibble, are you want to move one or just start a discussion
I'd like to
get comments.
I know the chamber wrote this bill, I'd love their response and reaction. I'd like the chief author's response and reaction. If we're agreeable to moving on these amendments now, I don't want to offer an amendment that's going to fail, but I'd like at least an opportunity to have the discussion about these ideas.
I just
Senator
want
Benson.
To, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble, on the A3 amendment, with actual and avoided energy purchases, we're talking about avoiding expanding a coal plant or the cost of coal. Wondering how that would be mirrored, because if we expanded another kind of energy, it almost seems like we'd have to create a web of, well, if we did hydro, then we don't have to build wind. But if we did wind, we don't have to do solar. I'm not exactly sure how cleanly this information would come out, and I'm wondering if you've given any thought to that.
Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Senator Benson. it might be useful to hear from the agency or the Utilities Commission about integrated resource plans and the information that they contain. But I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the IRPs do show that sort of data, anticipated what we're going to bring online, and what we don't need to bring online, et cetera. So I think because it's built in the IRP process, which is a great idea, we get to some of that information.
Ms. O'Connell, welcome. If you could introduce yourself to the tape.
Thank you, Kate O'Connell from the Department of Commerce. I appreciate the question, and it does highlight what does go into an integrated resource plan. what the plan does, we have this huge computer model called Strategist that does look at all of the various options. It will simultaneously look at a multitude of plans. So what my understanding we would be looking at is comparing the cost of wind to the next least cost alternative. And Strategist would do the behind the scenes, comparing this to that and so forth. But we wouldn't have to determine, compare hydro to solar. That would drive us all nuts. But Strategist will do that for us. So it's a very complicated analysis, and it is a good question to find out what the cost is of the renewables. And it's part of what we're already doing. What this bill would do is take it a step further. We come up with what's called present value of revenue requirements. So we look at the revenue requirements of one plan as opposed to another plan that has different alternatives added year by year. What this proposal would do is take that revenue to the next level to say, what are the rate impacts? So that's just to let you know, part of it is already being done, and this would add another analysis to that.
Ms. O'Connell, does that program factor in tax or other incentives that might be going on with different power sources, whether it's coal, wind, petroleum-based?
Mr. Chair, it will look at, and members, it will look at all of the costs that are known. For example, it'll include the heat rates, it'll include emissions, it will include expected costs due to EPA's rulemaking, for example. So it tries to incorporate as best it possibly can all of the various costs. And even with that, this is the kind of thing that we tell it to run overnight, and then we come back the next day. It's, in this day and age with huge computers, it takes that long for it to be done. So we include all the costs we possibly can.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. O'Connell? Senator Howell?
Mr. Chair, I think it might already be covered in there with the term without limitation, but I think it would be good to have it in there. But I'm looking for a clarification on subsidies. Is the subsidies that we give to the energy included in those cost analysis?
Ms. O'Connell?
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, what we're looking at is what the costs are for ratepayers. So if there are subsidies that are incorporated in there, if you're talking about tax subsidies, mm-hmm. Those would be incorporated into what the actual costs are. So, for example, if one particular kind of generation gets a subsidy, we would not include the full cost. We would include the net cost. So the subsidy would be incorporated because we want to look at what the what the ratepayers would pay.
Senator Mr. Hall. Chair, so it doesn't take in the actual formula here, or when we review this, doesn't take into any tax incentives or tax exemptions or anything like that. You're just looking at the ratepayer cost. You're not looking at what maybe the taxpayer cost or the actual cost would be, because you're including that subsidies into that.
Ms. O'Connell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, if you're talking about do we look at the effect on taxpayers? No, we're looking at the effect on ratepayers, yes.
Right, so.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Benson.
I actually have a question. I think perhaps Ms. O'Connell can answer. Do the utilities do the IRPs, or who's responsible for bringing forward this information? One of my concerns is that we might be asking utilities to do something they're not already doing. If you could help me.
Ms. O'Connell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the answer is both the utilities and the agency. Does this work? So the utilities will come forward with their strategist or whatever their plan is, whatever their software is. They'll come forward with their proposal. We'll look at it and say, we think this assumption is not reasonable. That assumption, you should look at maybe some different kinds of contingencies. So it will be both the utility and the agency that will do that work.
The only comment I have on the A3 amendment is that this bill in the, the non-A3 or 4 amendment has been talked about greatly with each of the utilities that would have to comply with this.
Mm-hmm.
And my fear is that by just if we adopted it today without having a broader discussion, that I feel that there might be an unintended consequence. So I think that the ideas of the amendment are fine. It's just that I've experienced in my brief stint as a advocate that sometimes it's more than just one person in a room that's opinion counts. So that's where I would think that if the utility, if we could have this out here and have the utilities and, you know, the OES or the PUC, whoever is interested in it, kind of have some time to think about it, and we could move the bill without these amendments. In the House, we haven't voted on it either. It's talked about for inclusion in an omnibus. So I don't think that there's any opposition to the idea of it, but without sort of a fine-tooth comb on the language, I think that at this point I would not be able to say that I could support it because the process had included all of the folks that would be affected by this.
And
thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I haven't had time to digest these so much as, and we discussed before, some wording changes that would make this more open and you know, not just dealing with the renewable electricity, but including all forms of electricity so that we're clear as we go forward. Haven't had the full chance to digest the A3 amendment and what burden in reporting that might put on people. I'm still learning what an IRP is and how that process works. And so I respectfully ask you to work with me, and we can pull this language together, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, that's great. Mr. Chair. Yeah, and that's fine. What is the anticipated path of this bill?
It is my understanding we're going to dual track this. We're going to move it to the floor and also leave the option of putting it into an omnibus bill. And if it does move to the floor, let's work on language so that we get an amendment that works for everybody.
Great.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Senator Dibble, my quick comment on the 8-3. We were looking at it here, and to put avoided, though we in the committee might understand where we're going with that, I don't know if that language gets to what you're looking for. It's kind of fuzzy language unless we can define, you know, in terms of conservation and things, how we're trying to calculate that. That's just my impression on that one. And on the A4, knowing how closed book, shall we say, that the utility companies are on power purchase agreements, and how hard people work to get those power purchase agreements in a form that seems okay to them. I guess I think about the Hobenschild farm and how long they waited in between times to get the power purchase agreement. I talked to some other folks. I think we should talk to some of the power companies and find out, you know, what kind of information they'd have to release about those, because I know they don't like everybody to know what kind of money, though we would like to know how that works. I think it should be more of a standard thing. I think they negotiate all those separately, and I know they keep it, you know, pretty tight-lipped about how those work. So we might want to get some ideas, though. It would be great for us to understand so we know that if somebody builds a facility, what are they, in fact? What can they expect to get in a power purchase agreement? So I think you're asking great questions. We just need to find out how they put all that together to what kind of information will they release to us to make these valid in a reporting system. So.
Thanks. I appreciate that. That's good advice, Mr. Chair. But just to restate the intent behind the A4, and that is to, you know, it's actually pretty straightforward if you read it. It's easy. It would be easy to compare, new wind today to old coal from a fully depreciated facility. It's also easy to pick out a point in time, you know, and not really factor in the changing costs over a period of time. And some generation lasts longer than others. Some take significant capital rehab on a shorter time frame. Those sorts of things really need to be factored in. That's, you know, to the benefit and or the detriment of you know, some forms of renewable. Additionally, like I said before, we need to make sure that the supporting infrastructure is allocated appropriately among different sources so that we're not attributing that new every KV line from the ridge over to wherever fully to a wind farm, for example. So yeah, I'm you know, perfectly happy to not to actually formally move these amendments, but appreciate the offer of Senator Benson to continue this conversation so that we are actually doing what the intent of the bill is.
Senator Dittles, I think you bring up a lot of good things, and you know, I've been pretty passionate about wind, for example, or any kind of renewable energy, where if you put it to your own home, you're basically net metering, spinning the meter backwards. But if you sell it on a power purchase agreement, you get, you know, a portion of that, and so it takes a lot longer to pay it back. And I don't think people really know what all those numbers are, and I think it would be good to know that. You know, with Excel in the room, can I say things? No. We talk about whether you can put something on a campus and spin, you know, net meter, or, you know, how do you have to organize some of them things? I think the general public needs to know more about that, too, so they know, make wiser investments in those renewables and how exactly all that pays itself back. So I think you get to the heart of a lot of those things that if we knew, we could make better resource planning. So any other questions? Senator Sparks?
Not to this point.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it maybe goes to the entire bill, or maybe just a general question, because Senator Howe brought up this question of ratepayer versus taxpayer, and so I see we're doing the rate impact of this report. Is there any report that's actually giving us what the impact on the taxpayer is? I'm just curious.
Not Senator Benson.
I am not aware of any reports that tell us what the RES impact on the taxpayer would be. Right now, we're focused on consumers, and PUC's job is to protect the consumers, and so we're working through that mechanism. But perhaps on the taxpayers is another thought.
Okay, thanks. Just curious.
Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just Ms. Seifert quickly. The initial report must be submitted within 150 days, the effective date of this section. I'm just curious as how or why that number was chosen.
Ms. Seifert?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, that number was chosen after some folks had suggested 25, some folks had suggested 180. We went back and forth with 60, 90, and then 150, they said, well, that's what we're looking for streamlining permitting. That seems like a reasonable amount of time for folks to get things together that's not too onerous. But it really was just talking to everyone and finally saying, like, okay, is anyone really unhappy with 150? And there was no really unhappy, so it won.
Okay. Thank you.
There you go. Sparky.
So there.
Good logic.
Any more questions?
Good logic.
Senator Benson, what's your wishes with the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd appreciate your support for Senate File 1093. I'd like to move this to the floor with the option to recall it for inclusion in an omnibus bill at the discretion of the chair. As amended.
As amended, yes. So Senator Benson has moved that Senate File 1093, as amended, be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion carries. Senate File 1093 as amended will be moved to the floor.
Now, what bill are we on? Okay.
I'm finding it.
Just a warning, I might have to take off again here. I've got another bill up. So, Senate File 817. Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is a two-part bill. The first part. Actually, I apologize. There is an A3 delete all amendment, and I would like to move that amendment at this time.
Senator Benson moves the A3 amendment, and it is a delete everything. Senator Benson, would you like to just explain briefly the changes on the amendment?
You should be saying what you mean.
The changes. To the original bill were made after one of those meetings, trying to keep everybody happy, kind of a 150 discussion. Some of the language was burdensome to the PUC, and we wanted to make it possible for them to do their job well. I'm sorry, to do their job well without having to add additional staff, therefore taking care of the fiscal note issue. There was some additional reporting that was going to be required, and we changed the wording so that we accomplished the goals of the bill without killing more trees and burning more people's time. And that's the purpose of the amendment.
So, Senator Benson, this fiscal note is null and void then. Is that correct?
Null and void, yes.
Okay. In your packet, let's just pitch that. Any questions on the A3 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Senator Benson.
Members of the committee, there are two parts to this legislation. I'll speak to them briefly and then invite testifiers up to speak. First part supports the idea that our energy decisions should be based on economic cost. Our energy inputs are one of the most expensive parts of some of our key industries here in Minnesota, and so having the actual cost of delivering energy to businesses and homes should be reflected in the rate. The other part of the bill has to do with block rates for natural gas consumption in homes, and we would be not repealing the current study that's going on, but removing language that it would allow it to continue after the study was completed. There's been quite a bit of negative consumer response at the PUC, and so we are accommodating that consumer response by stopping block rates from going forward once the study's completed. And with that, members, I'm going to have Bride Seifert, she's listed number three, but I'm going to have her come up and do her testifying first.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Hello, Ms. Seifert.
Bride Seifert, Energy Policy Manager at the Minnesota Chamber. You heard Senator Benson talk briefly about this bill. Mr. Moratzka and Mr. Pagel will as well. One thing I want to talk to you about is what this bill does. And there are some folks that feel that it strips the PUC of some of their authority. We don't feel it does that at all. We feel it simply requires that cost be the primary consideration for allocating rates. It makes sense for us to charge people utility rates based on the cost that they incur on the system. And according to theory, that's already being done right now, both at the PUC and the OES, that cost is, you know, a major driver, and there are adjustments. It's just not in the statute. We're looking for some protection in the statute. The Public Utilities Commission can still consider non-cost factors, and it will. That's part of the things that the A3 amendment does. It says, you know, factors other than cost may be considered. So it does add one more consideration to their toolbox of non-cost factors, and that's job and economic growth. The reason that's important is for years there's been some folks that feel that business can just absorb or pass on any rate increases. That really wasn't true in the 1970s, and it's not true today in our more global economy. So the idea that, hey, you should consider cost, you should consider a whole host of non-cost factors, but one of them should be jobs and economic growth, really makes sense, especially from some of our large users, that 25% of their cost of doing business is a utility bill. And when they get dinged a little bit, it might only seem like a little bit at the time, but over the course of years and in between rate cases, that can add up to a substantial cost. The second thing I want to talk about is that message to our job creators. There needs to be that idea of equity in our rate-making process. And we're not going to get our businesses to grow here, to come here, or create jobs here if they don't have some comfort level with how costs are allocated. People pay very, very close attention to the rate-making process. Maybe not everybody in this room or everyone in this building, but we have folks that are looking to buy and revitalize a very large energy facility in southern Minnesota. They are waiting for the outcome of a utility rate case to help them make that decision. We also have a data center that's thinking of coming to our great state. They have a small business here. They have a data center somewhere. They might like some more. Again, it is a fearfulness on utility rates and not just the rate, but the rate-making policy that gives them pause. The chamber is out every single day with multiple businesses saying, come here. We are a great place to do business. This bill helps give them a little bit of comfort, especially if they are a large energy user, which often does translate into a large job provider as well. So you might hear from some low-income advocates that they don't support this bill and that they're not comfortable with it. But again, the tools are available to the commission to offset any concerns with that. But I want to let you know that the current fix is often to subsidize an entire class. And that means someone making $200,000 a year gets the same subsidy as someone that's barely making ends meet. And that just doesn't make sense. A program that is targeted on low-income folks is the answer for that type of issue, not a broad-scale, across-the-board subsidy based on the idea that, hey, businesses can pass on and absorb rates. The other thing I want to mention is that it's not just about a single rate case. There was in recent history a substantial deviation from cost that caused a lot of heartburn for our large energy users. But this has been an issue in every rate case that the chambers intervened in, and I think we've been involved with 9 of them in the last, 5 years or something like that. So sometimes it's a major issue, sometimes it's a small issue, but it's always there. And again, that 1% might not make much of a difference to, let's say, you or I, but if I'm someone using tons and tons of energy, that 1% makes a tremendous difference in my cost of doing business. And lastly, it's not all about the large industrials. It's not all about our biggest users. Our membership has been working towards and talking about cost-based rates for years. And we've got small businesses that support it, large businesses that support it, and again, they're an issue in every case. Some of the folks that do support it are our Bushel Boy Tomatoes. You've heard Jay Johnson talk before. He makes great tomatoes. He's a big user, but not one of the biggest. He supports it. We've got an IT management, Medtronic, Minnesota Freezers. I mean, they keep our ice cream cold. We've got rope makers, Minnesota Metal Casters. They've got 32 foundries in the state, and they're fully supportive of this bill. So I think it's important not just for our large energy users, but for manufacturing, industrial, and anyone that's even mildly intensive energy across the state. And we ask that you support it.
Thank you, Ms. Seifert. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Metzen.
I'm just curious, talking about the tools. On subdivision 6 on page 2, factors considered by the commission, it looks like we're diluting on 212 some of the commission's duties now
on
the fair rate of return by taking out the commission shall give due consideration. And then going down to 219, on the expense part of the equation, capital nature.
Senator Metzen, are you looking at the delete all amendment, the A3?
I don't know what I'm looking at.
Okay.
No, that's the original.
Did I get the wrong one?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you and I are a good team today, Heather, aren't we?
All right. It's probably the same question. It's different.
No, I think it's different.
Maybe not. I don't know. That's not in the revised A3 amendment, Council?
I don't think so. I don't think so. It's completely different. And you're talking about
rate reference. Factors considered.
Senator Metzen, that's what I was on in the first bill. That very paragraph that you were just talking about, very funny. So
right, maybe it's not. Maybe you know.
I know exactly what it is. Madam Chair,
sure.
Senator Metzen, that was part of the discussion that ended up in a separate subdivision 6E so that there is no concern or no worry that that will affect the utility's ability for their general considerations. So that was, we talked about folks, and it wasn't exactly clear. That's why we said put it in a separate section, 6E. That's going to keep the language of the original subdivision 6 where it talks about rate of return and all of that. That's going to remain intact and won't be touched at all.
That clarifies, yes, so nothing's changed, Madam Chair and members. So that's good news to me. So there's another look-see in there, and Okay. Sorry, I missed that.
Perfect. That's great.
First mistake I made this year. maybe not.
No, I believe that. Any other questions for Ms. Seifert? Would you like to just stay up there while we bring another person up? We might have more questions for you. Mr. Andrew Maratska, please, from Energy, your attorney from Macau. Oh, forget it. Welcome, Mr. Maratska.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman, committee. Yes, my name is Andrew Maratska. I am an attorney at Makel, Crowns, and Moore. I represent large industrial customers and matters before the Public Utilities Commission, including general rate cases. So that means that I have kind of a ground floor experience as to what it's like to go toe-to-toe with the utility, the other parties, et cetera, on issues such as revenue allocation before administrative law judges and then, of course, the Public Utilities Commission. I am here today to let you know that I have been frustrated on more than one occasion where the commission largely ignored cost of service in allocating the rate increase among the various customer classes. I will disagree with any claim that cost is always the primary consideration. I think that utilities have started to become fairly cognizant that that is not the case, that the commission and government agencies view this as a policy decision. There is some social engineering that goes on, and oftentimes there is not much effort on the utility's behalf to pay much attention to this issue because their position may not be considered and may be ignored. That was even something that I raised during cross-examination of a utility's witness in a recent case, and they agreed that not much consideration was paid to revenue allocation because it wasn't their decision anyway. I thought that that was refreshingly honest, but I also find it fairly troubling. The judgment that the commission has exercised is sometimes good, but sometimes questionable. In a recent case, the large industrial group that I represent was assessed a $39 million rate increase. That is amounted to 16.1%, and it should be noted that the utility was awarded about $54 million in total. So the industrial customers paid 72% of the rate increase, and I don't think that that was justified by the cost studies that were filed in that case. In fact, had cost been given some consideration, the rate increase for the large industrial class could have been anywhere from $8 to $12 million less. That's a lot of money. We're not here to ask that you strip the commission of its authority to consider non-cost factors, as Ms. Seifert indicated. We don't think that this bill does that. We just think it makes cost the primary consideration, and we think that is very important, and it will provide greater certainty in this area, which is largely uncertain given all the cost increases that will likely come in the future. So we support 817 as amended, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for Mr. Maratska?
Maratska.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Maratska. Mr. Pagel.
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Pagel. I am the president of the Iron Mining Association. And members, a little background of the Iron Mining Association. We're a trade association of the six taconite mines located in northeastern Minnesota, as well as about 180 companies that provide products and services to assure that those mines are able to run on a daily basis. Those six mines in a study developed by the University of Minnesota account for 34% of the gross regional product of northeastern Minnesota. That's about $3.1 billion annually that is brought into the economy. And what's interesting is the demand for iron ore is increasing as the demand for steel around the world increases as well. Because of that, we have several new members to the Iron Mining Association. One of those is magnetation. They actually built during the recession. It's a new type of process as we continue to develop our technology. We also have magnetation, which is mining some of the old mine sites. And presently under construction this summer is a $1.6 billion project that is the first iron to steel on the range. So the total construction costs we're looking at over the next several years, we've actually had some of them with magnetation being built, is about $5 billion in new construction. Once that's completed, the annual impact will double. It will go from $3 billion to $6 billion a year. That also means a lot of jobs. For every one miner, there's 1.8 other employed directly in helping support the mine outside of the mines themselves. Right now, that's about 9,000 people. But what's more fun about it is I made the mistake of seeing that the annual average salary is about $65,000 a year. That's not true. I've been told it's more like $100,000 right now. And job entering, job in one of the mines, driving one of the large production trucks, which some of you saw when you toured the mine, their salary is $26 an hour. I believe that's a little bit more than the legislators are making right now. So these are very high-paying jobs, highly technical jobs. And I think what's also important about that is we pay a lot of taxes. The six mines alone pay over $100 million in taxes during a normal year. We also add about $19 million is the estimate I've got for the next 4 years for each year that will be going to the University Trust Fund as well as to the K-12. However, while the outlook is really looking great up on the range right now, there is one concern, and that concern is the cost of energy. As you heard, 25% of our costs are for energy alone, and one of the largest ones is electricity. The unfortunate thing is, as our costs go up, we cannot exactly pass those costs on because we're dealing with a commodity that's based and set on a global market. As you heard from Mr. Maratska, the PUC's rate decision seemed to not have taken into account the cost to deliver electricity to all customers. And as an example, I want to kind of give an idea, especially those that were there and saw the mines. We receive our power at 115,000 or 230,000 volts. The mines own the substations and all the distribution beyond that. So basically, we're taking our power right off the transmission grids. Other customers, however, have to have more substations to step it down from the 115 and the 230 down to distribution voltages and all the substations and the people that are needed to run that. Yet the mines have historically paid up to 20% of the residential rate. That is before the most recent Minnesota Power rate case where the PUC decision placed almost all the 14% increase on the industrial customers alone. As an example, when the legislature passes fees, it has to be based on the service that the person is receiving. Fishing licenses, use of state land as examples. However, it doesn't seem that the PUC is bound by that same requirement. So Senate File 817 gives direction to the PUC to use the cost of service as one of the considerations setting rates. It does four things. One, it gives a better reflection of the market cost of the energy they are using, the customers are using. Two, makes customers more responsible for their energy use. We've heard a lot about conservation and how we need to know what those costs actually are. Three, shows customers the true cost of energy and other mandates. And four, assures industries who provide jobs are attracted to Minnesota. In closing, companies will decide where to make capital improvements and expansions based on operating costs. Energy is one of the largest costs they must consider. Senate File 817, as amended, assures that they will get a true reflection of what those costs are as they compete in a global market.
Thank you, Mr. Pagel. Any questions for Mr. Pagel? If not, we'll call up our next testifier, Ron Elwood. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I have didn't get a chance to talk personally with Senator Benson, but I did communicate via email with her about the concerns of the bill during the break because we were not available. So I apologize for not being able to get to you personally. And I have spoken with Ms. Seifert on this bill. So I want to talk to you not today not only as representing Legal Aid, but also from my background, 15 years with the New York State Public Service Commission as utility regulator. I also hate to be the lone voice here in opposition, but all I can say is welcome to my world. I would respectfully disagree with Ms. Seifert that, and Mr. Pagel, that this is not mere direction in this bill to the commission. It is dictating to the commission. It is a major and, in my view, troubling departure from well-settled regulatory process. It's the phrase, the primary factor, which is the problematic phrase. If we're going to talk about giving the commission more tools, more direction, then I would suggest to you that the phraseology should be something more like cost of service should be a consideration in addition to all the other factors, which would include, I would submit, economic or business development and job growth should absolutely be a consideration. If this bill is passed, I believe it would do harm to small business consumers across the state as well as to residential customers. And frankly, this, in my view, constitutes an unwarranted intrusion by the legislature on the PUC's independence and ability to do its job. Rate setting and rate allocation are very complex and highly technical areas, and the legislature really does not possess the depth of understanding that the PUC possesses and exercises in its duties. This bill would hamstring the commission. It would dictate the outcomes of before the facts are even heard in the cases. In Minnesota Supreme Court has observed in a case of St. Paul Chamber versus PUC that the cost of service has historically been the basis for rates. You've heard that that's not true, but and you also heard that this is not about one case, although, of course, the two testifiers talked about the Minnesota Power case. Let me read what the commission said in its order in that case. Commission said, commission makes these rate design decisions on the basis of the cost of service, listed number one, on economic efficiency, on continuity with prior rates, ease of understanding, ease of administration, ability to pay, and other factors. And the problem with this bill is that it would take away that discretion from the commission to weigh the other factors accordingly. The other problem with the bill is the making cost of service king is that these cost of service studies are inexact. As one court of appeals stated, cost analyses do not produce a precise inflexible cost of service for any individual class of service because cost analysis involves judgment. Its principal value is in determining the minimum cost attributable, but other factors must be considered. And thus, the PUC must be allowed to exercise its judgment based on all the factors, weigh those factors accordingly based on existing circumstances. And finally, I would just suggest to you that Sections 1 and 2 appear to conflict with Section 3 because the rate discrimination, as we all understand it, is based on to mean within classes, not among classes. So in other words, the house, single-family house on Elm Street has to be charged the same rate as a single-family house in Maple Street in XL service territory. So I would argue that the first two sections contradict the third. So in short, in sum, while I understand the impetus behind the bill, I believe that it inappropriately substitutes the legislature's judgment for the commission, and we should think very, very, very carefully before moving forward on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Any questions for Mr. Elwood? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, thanks, Mr. Chair, and a question for Mr. Elwood. Is it fair to say that if this bill passes into law, residential customers will be picking up an increase in their utility bills? All residential customers, not just low-income residential customers.
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I think that would absolutely be the result. And not only residential customers, but small business customers as well, because there are typically three classes. This would favor the largest class at the expense of the other two.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elwood, how do you respond to some of the opening testimony from Ms. Seifert stating that we should go ahead with this proposal and then find some other tools to low-income folks, therefore the issues you raise can be dealt with through some other means or mechanism?
Mr. Elwood.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, as it pertains to the overall rate allocation, as you mentioned, low-income customers would be in the same boat as non-low-income customers, as residential customers. With respect to the inverted rates issue, I think the commission, again, should have the broadest possible discretion to set rates, allocate rates, and design rates as it sees fit based on a particular case, the existing circumstances, the facts of the case, and most importantly, of course, the record before it. I think we've done a good job in Minnesota in creating some tools for low-income customers with the affordability programs that all the utilities have been really generous about supporting. I guess the answer to that question is I would agree with Ms. Seifert that we ought to create as many tools as possible to assist low-income customers to afford utility service, and that benefits and reduce their uncollectibles, which benefits all customers.
Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to propose the first question Senator Dibble just asked to Ms. Seifert on residential rates. What is your opinion? Do you believe we would see residential rates increase?
I don't believe that we would. Part of it is that because it's based on cost, more often than not, a large business is a little bit cheaper than a residential customer. But whatever the cost it may be, if cost indicates that, and it does change from utility, and rate case to rate case, that if the small businesses or the large businesses incur more costs onto the system, they are happy to pay that. And as far as the concern about the small businesses having any type of negative effect from this, 80% of our members are small businesses and are supporting this bill. So if it is a concern for them, they haven't mentioned it to the chamber. And as far as residents go, again, it's not about one rate case, but that there is one particular rate case that was pretty bad. Most of the times when you see a shift, they're relatively small. So if this did become a law and there was something that said, okay, here's the next cost of service study, the residents might have a 1% increase more because of this. But it is to be determined, and it is also very much part of the PUC's non-cost factors, that ability to pay, economic situations, and rate prevention of rate shock is one that they always talk about. They don't want a rate to go up too fast on any residents. So that is something that they're always talking about and they're always thinking of. One thing to keep in mind is that nothing like that exists for the business class. There is no rate shock or subsidy of any form of available to the business class when in the current process. So,
thank you.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Marotska, when he was testifying, said there would be an $8 to $12 million, I don't know if he said difference, in what the large ratepayer would pay. And I am wondering, it's going to be born somewhere in the system. And I'm guessing if it's not the large ratepayer, it is going to be on the other two classes. So I want you to comment on that. I mean, I'm guessing it is going to be borne by small businesses and the consumer.
Well, it would be borne based, again, on cost of service and other factors. Mm-hmm. This law doesn't say that would absolutely change the outcome of the most recent case. But that would be based, if it was closer to what Mr. Moratzka alluded to, a multi-million, let's say $10 million difference, then that would be spread whatever those classes, whatever cost indicated on that. Again, they still have the other tools, and it may or may, it's based on what you incur in the system. So what if?
But it would make, Mr. Chair, it would spread it to the other classes.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it actually couldn't do anything retroactively. So all of this is going forward. I can't say what the outcome of that case would have been had this been here. But again, cost has, in theory, always been I don't know if primary is the right word, but a significant driver. They start at cost and then make their differences from there. But again, if it is, it's the idea of the bill is to say cost should be the primary driver. You can still make those adjustments. But frankly, I didn't even know I got a subsidy until I started doing rate work, and I thought I'm not a big fan of that type of rate design. I'm more a fan of if there's a subsidy to actually let folks know they're getting it.
Senator Benson, did you have something you wanted to interject as we went back and forth here?
We're covering it. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Ms. Chair, are we going to hear from the commission or from the agency?
We have the agency here, and I guess I had a question before we bring them up, because I think I agree somewhat with maybe all the way with Mr. Elwood, that when you say cost of service shall be the primary consideration, just by that one word, you are automatically in every case bringing it to the top. And I don't know if that was your intention, Senator Benson. That is your intention, to make sure it's the top consideration in every case.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Elwood.
Just one final word. This isn't the first time this has been an issue. In fact, in 1977 and 1993, similar complaints by large users were brought to before the Minnesota Supreme Court. And it was the same issue. The cost of service was not adequately considered. And in both cases, the court rejected the plaintiff's complaint. And in very strong language said that, A, the commission does consider cost of service, and, B, the commission must have the flexibility to determine which factors have which weight in any particular case. And I think that's very salient to the discussion today.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Mr. Wolf, or anybody from the PUC want to come up and comment on how this will affect the direction of the PUC?
Mr. Chair, Wolf. Members of the committee, Dan Wolf, Assistant Executive Secretary with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. We do certainly appreciate the opportunity to work with stakeholders in this legislation. As you can see by the Delete Everything Amendment, the bill has changed substantially since introduction, and we appreciate the opportunity to have those discussions. And as Senator Benson mentioned, one of the ramifications of that is that the fiscal note has gone down to zero, because the initial language talked about building a higher level of record evidence to support a decision than is currently the case. So we've moved to a point where now the A3 amendment, we do have a number of concerns. I'd like to just point those out based upon your request for us to do so. These concerns reflect a conversation that we've had with the commission, and it's a consensus of the commission as to those concerns. We certainly do not support or oppose legislation. It's our job to carry out what direction the policymakers give us, and we're happy to do that. But again, you know, since it affects the commission's responsibilities, just thought we'd raise a couple of points in that regard. We've heard a number of testifiers here on this bill talk about the expertise and the good work of the commission, and we appreciate that and concur in that evaluation. And we see, you know, this bill, you know, again, reasonable people differ, but we do see it as a limitation on the ability of the commission to do its best judgment, its property terminations. We think that it would impede the ability of the commission to exercise those decision-making process that you have charged us to do. The determinations that the commission make is based on a tremendous amount of input. There's substantial evidence built up by the parties, by participants, by interveners. There's public input. There's all kinds of testimony, deliberations, and ultimately the commission makes its decisions on a case-by-case basis. And so we think that flexibility should remain for the commission to make those decisions based upon all of that evidence and on a case-by-case basis as the merits of each matter dictate. Secondly, specifically as to Section 3 of the A3 Amendment, I'm not sure if you would have thought there was this much controversy raised by an article between an A and a the, but that is, in fact, the case, at least in our viewpoint. We think that the cost of service, you know, is certainly a factor and even a primary factor, but we think that this language goes too far, if you will, to make it a preeminent factor to be determined, to be considered in determining that revenue allocation among classes. As you see on, 1.23 talks about the primary consideration, and we think that that's putting it more equal than others, I guess, if you will, as George Orwell talked about. And so we think that maybe shall be a primary consideration would be a more appropriate article in that instance rather than the primary consideration. And again, we need to give all of those factors their proper weight on a case-by-case basis. And then the language on 1.24 and 1.25, you know, again, is a policy consideration, and we'll take whatever direction that the legislature gives us, but I just want you to be aware that that is a new factor, you know, in terms of considering the impact on business development and job growth. There's been 30 years of case law and commission actions in determining what these other factors are, and so this would interject a new factor in that consideration, and it, again, it does say including, but as any good lawyer will use to their advantage, when you talk about, well, there's a bunch of other stuff you can talk about, but includes this thing, they're going to focus on this thing. And so it does say factors other than the cost of service, including impact on business, but we think that would, again, create that a greater equal among others than the other factors there. So, again, those are the concerns that the commission has expressed, and I wanted to just respond to your request for our input and raise those with the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. My first question, you know, understanding and hearing that some of these have gone to the Supreme Court, so when the PUC makes a decision and somebody disagrees with that decision, there is a remedy, and it's in the courts. So we've heard where the court has agreed with the PUC. Are there times we could hear about that the court disagrees with the PUC?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Gonzalez. I'm the Energy Unit Manager at the Public Utilities Commission. We have a pretty good record of winning court cases. That's certainly not universally true. I'm not aware of any rate design or rate allocation case that the commission's lost. Now, I can't absolutely, you know, swear to that I would know what everyone was, but I'm not aware of any in this particular area that where the court has said, wait a minute, you did the wrong thing. Certainly we have had adverse court decisions in other areas.
Members, other questions? Juan, this is so controversial. Mm-hmm. We should have well, it's interesting to me because I guess the reason we typically change something is somebody feels they're cheated or don't really have a remedy. And so, but it does concern me if it's gone to court and maybe the outcome always comes out the same. So help me again through this, maybe, Ms. Rolfe. Are the PUC's requirements on rate cases so spelled out that the court just goes through those and says, yes, you did all your due diligence, and that if we think that we need to go a different direction, it needs to be spelled out this clearly? Does that question make sense?
Well, or I think, you know, obviously the Attorney General's staff is the counsel to the commission and would be better served on administrative law than perhaps, you know, my law school experience from 35 years ago. But there certainly are factors as an agency. You're certainly given discretion by the courts to make a determination, but you're still held to a standard that those have to be reasonable determinations. And so the court will look at those factors and has to exercise some judgment as to whether those factors have been met appropriately by the decision of the commission.
And then, Mr. Wolfe, the court considers that you use the same standard over and over again and you're not setting a new precedent. And Mr. Elwood, did you have something to add into that? I see Mr. Elwood kind of chomping at the bit on that as well. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. You know, the reason that the commission's record in court is really good is because what the courts typically do is provide the deference to the regulatory agency that it deserves, because the court says over and over, not only here in Minnesota, but all across the country and even up to the United States Supreme Court, that it does not have the level of technical expertise to second guess these decisions. And that's why it's not a question of, well, let me, you know, throw it up to the court and maybe sometimes you win, it's half and half. No, it's not that way, because the courts are very careful to make sure that they give the appropriate deference to the experts. And I would submit to you this is the same situation. The legislature is sort of in the same position as the courts. The PUC are the experts, and the deference should be there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Senator Vandeveer?
Mr. Chair, for Mr. Elwood, maybe you could tell me, I'm still having trouble grasping why the cost of providing the service is not the reasonable, just, most prevalent factor in determining the rate for reimbursing that cost. Why that is the wrong thing to do.
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and Senator Vandeveer, it's not that it is an inappropriate factor. It's an important factor. In virtually every court case that has been heard on this, the court says the same thing. The PUC in its own order on the case that precipitated this bill said exactly the same thing. The cost of service is an extremely important factor. It's just that there are so many other factors. Affordability, for example, is a huge factor. And so are a variety of other factors that the commission needs to take into account that is based on the record before it. So to sort of put your what this bill essentially does is put your finger on the scale before even the facts are even heard in the case, before the record is even developed, to say that this one thing is going to primarily dictate how these how the costs are allocated among classes. So the commission determines the utility needs X dollars to run its business for the next X number of years, and here's how much each class is going to contribute to that. And so, therefore, it's not that it's not important. It's extremely important. And it has typically been a fundamental factor in deciding who pays what.
Mr. Chair and Mr.
Senator Vandeveer,
I think that's because the primary outcome is going to be a cross-subsidy by the other classes if cost isn't the most prevalent one. And how just is that? And I think that's why the natural place to go is to the cost of the service.
Mr. Elwood.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Vanderveer, the term of art is that rates have to be just and reasonable. Just and reasonable comprise a whole host of factors, cost of service being one of them. So I think from a regulatory standpoint, it is not simply how much it just costs to serve one group of customers that determines how much the rates are or how they're allocated, but yet a host of all other factors that's before the commission that the large industrials provide, and they are certainly well represented in all these cases, PUC decides, what the department comes in and says, here are the various considerations before you, commission, weigh all these and come out with a fair and reasonable and just and reasonable rate and rate allocation. So I think, again, it depends on the eye of the beholder as to which ones are more important. That's why we have the commission. That's precisely why we have the commission. That's precisely why they need to have the utmost discretion to make these determinations on a case-by-case basis.
I see Mr. Marotzko's. Looks like you have something else to add to the... Thank you, and welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Just briefly, if indeed, as the Mr. Elwood said, that all the commission orders state that cost is the primary starting point, this should not be an objectionable bill, because all we're doing is putting that into legislation. And second, there doesn't appear to be a remedy in the courts, because according to Mr. Elwood, the commission is always given deference, and so when there is a situation such as what happened in the Minnesota Power case, we have no remedy.
Thank you. Members, other questions? Seifert.
Mr. Chair and committee members, one thing I just want to point out to folks is that the words and na are very important here, because when you put cost as the primary factor, that's one cost, or that's one factor. There's about 8 other factors. So you've got one that is sort of the starting point, and then you've got conservation, ability to pay. Again, things in statute that legislators added as guidance. Other things come from common law and just PUC history. Ease of understanding, continuity with prior rates, economic efficiency, ability to bear, ability to pass on. These come, so there's a host of non-cost factors and one cost factor. This bill helps say that one cost factor should be a little bit more important than all of these. And I appreciate Senator Vanderveer's question on that, is when you talk about the other factors, no other factor stands out as the primary or the starting point for this discussion. And every non-cost factor is still included in the bill. And that is just what I want to sort of emphasize as I'm talking to you.
Well, Ms. Seifert and Mr. Marotzko, I guess the reason I'm asking so many questions is because we haven't talked about these kind of things, but I do know one thing. This is my 9th year here, and I know that the make a big, huge difference in bills. And as I'm reading through this, I'm just a little hesitant that the way it's written in the whole paragraph, that we're kind of redoing the whole structure, and I want to make sure, and I don't mind cost being the primary factor, or maybe even the primary factor, but I don't know about the primary consideration, because even those kind of words are very weighty in what we do here. And so I'm trying to understand everything to know where Senator Benson was trying to go with this. So,
Mr. Chair, I can probably help clarify. I believe that because energy is such a huge factor in our economy, and cost is a clearly measurable factor in businesses who consume energy, it should be the primary factor to avoid doing undue economic damage by supplanting cost with other considerations. The other considerations still have a valid place in the discussion, and they are included, but in a very transparent way. If there's going to be a cost subsidy, then let's state that loud and clear. Let's not do it behind closed doors or in a hidden way. Let's say we considered the cost, but it is also important that we provide this cost subsidy for other businesses and that we consider the impact on job development as we go forward. And that's why this paragraph is important as it is. And when we're talking about A's versus the, when I got married, I said, this is the man I'm going to marry. This is not a man I'm going to marry. I don't want him equal with everybody else.
Good point, Senator Benson. The reason I asked Senator Benson about remedies and about precedent, because those also become factors, and if we don't have a true remedy, if you will, when we shift this, and it doesn't sound like we're shifting it upside down, but I want to make sure we're putting it in place in a way where, again, there's a remedy in the future, and that the precedent we set, I don't know how that affects everything that's in process, so I don't want to get everybody back, so I won't go there, but Senator McGuire, you were...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And using the example of the marriage, I think it is, as we've been saying, and the is really important. And when you say the man you're going to marry, that is the only person that you're marrying. And I'm worried that they are going to say the primary consideration. It will be the only consideration. I disagree that they're not going to think that's such a major consideration. And I think it is important that we not be exclusive and say, we should say, if anything, not the, because we do want them to consider other things. Not like when you got married and you married the man that was the only one. We want there to be other considerations here, and so we want there to be there and not the. So I'm just saying that in statutory construction, they read that pretty clearly, and I think it's in dangerous territory that we're setting this as the sole consideration.
Mr. Chair,
Benson.
Senator McGuire, it is just so important that we're going to set it up here and that if you want to deviate from it, you better document why you're doing it and what impact that's going to have. So right now, there's not a sense of transparency. We need our business customers and even the residential customers who receive a subsidy to understand that they are receiving a subsidy. Or not receiving a subsidy. Right now, it's all very hidden, and a home on Summit Avenue with the ability to pay gets exactly the same treatment as somebody up Lincoln or off of Grand or way down on Goodrich. So,
Senator Dibble.
Well, I just fundamentally disagree that this is hidden. This is a subject of a rate, a very open rate process. I mean, those are by their very nature open. So I'm not sure what you refer to when you say hidden. I mean, granted, the average residential, even the average business customer probably doesn't pay attention to the proceedings of the PUC. They may not even know who the PUC is. I know that hurts Mr. Wolf's feelings. But I don't think this bill changes that fact. So I don't know about transparency or openness. I don't think that fundamentally changes. What I do understand, though, fairly clearly, is this is handing a significant reduction in energy costs to very large users in a state that has fairly cheap energy to start with, and handing a fairly significant increase in energy costs to residential users. Ms. Seifert disagrees, but I think it's quite clear the motivation behind this bill. And all the testimony has pointed to that, and even the opening testimony talked about that. And so, you know, I think that's clearly what's happening. But this argument about treating different residences and different levels similar then doesn't Senator Benson square with your repeal of the inverted block rate rate design. I know you're not repealing the pilot, but if the pilot proves to be successful, there's going to be no ability to pursue that. And so can we spend a minute talking about why you want to repeal that and all approach to rate design? I know that the agency might want to talk a little bit as well, or I might be curious to know what the agency's reaction, or I don't know if Gasco wants or CenterPoint wants to talk about whether or not the pilot is successful or not.
Senator Benson.
They're kind of hanging back there. No, they don't want to come up.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I don't like the way inverted block rates is structured.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I am really, if you have a household of mom, dad, six kids, mom homeschools, dad works from home, they heat their house all day. If you have eight single people living in apartments, which one actually uses more energy net?
Mm-hmm.
But the people that stay home and heat their houses and do their laundry get smacked pretty hard by inverted block rates. And I think if we're going to undertake social engineering through energy policy, then let's make it based on actual behaviors, not just you live in this house, we don't care what happens in it. So we can have that discussion at another time, but right now this is really pinching some pretty middle-class ordinary families, and that's my motivation for moving it out. We're going to finish the pilot program.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get the data because, frankly, it would be really painful at this point to end the pilot program, but I don't think it's well-structured.
But
Senator DeBoer.
So that's, maybe one end of the spectrum perspective. The other end of the spectrum perspective is it provides, social engineering is kind of a values-laden term.
It was
loaded, sending economic signals, providing economic incentives, that sort of thing is some of the idea behind the inverted block rate design. And there's the other side of the equation, which is, folks who flagrantly, leave their windows open or have huge houses or whatever, heat up their house with their oven. I don't know.
I know people who turn on their fireplace and open the window because they like sleeping in the cold, but they don't want it cold when they go downstairs. So they should pay for that privilege.
So some of the ideas, there's an economic signal that gets set if you're doing all the right things, and then incrementally as you get above those levels. So, are you open to the notion of taking a look at rate design techniques to send economic signals to support our conservation and efficiency goals as a state?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I'd love to sit down with you and talk about how to do that, because I know how I would change my behavior, and I think if you and I could come to an agreement on something like that, we'd be well on the way to achieving conservation and changing the way that energy is consumed in this state, and I'd be happy to have that conversation, maybe when we have the amendment conversation.
Great. Would you be, Mr. Chair?
Senator Dibble.
Senator Benson, would you be willing to restore those three words, rate and rate design, in the bill so that they continue to pursue rate design techniques?
I have some concern about putting rate design back in as we pulled it out, because I'm afraid I apologize, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble. I'm afraid it's just going to put us right back into inverted block rates. I don't think the PUC will make that change, but I think that we can continue working on other designs, bigger designs. It's something that I've been thinking about quite extensively, and I frankly need to learn more about how rate design looks.
Members, I think we're about ready to wrap this up, but Senator Benson, I do have to, I agree with you that I do not like the way these rates are done.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I'm going to interrupt. Senator Dibble, I've just received a note. The Office of Energy, I'm sorry, the Division of Energy
Resources.
Energy Resources. I apologize. I will learn. I just got the acronyms, and now they're changing them all. They too would like the rate design left in, and there's been enough discussion from the parties that I'm advocating for that I would be amenable to that change if you would like to offer an amendment.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
May I move that on line 3.3 we restore stricken words and rate design.
Any discussion on that verbal amendment? If not, Senator Dibble moves that on lines 3.3 the words "and rate design" be restored to the bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Aye. Same sign. That motion carries.
Anything else? Senator Benson, I'm back.
Welcome back, Madam Chair. I believe we've had a very good discussion. I hope that in the process of all this discussion, we've come to understand that this is about fundamental economics in energy policy and transparency. I'd ask for your support, and I would ask that this be moved to the floor with the option to include in an omnibus bill as amended.
As amended, okay. Senator Benson moves that Senate File 817, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor and into the omnibus bill. And Senator Dibble.
I'd like to request a roll call vote.
Roll call has been requested. Roll call will be taken. Okay. Assistant will take the roll.
Senator Rosen?
Yes.
Senator Benson?
Yes.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Howe? Senator Jungbauer?
Yes.
Senator Koch?
Yes.
Senator Kubley?
No.
Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator McGuire?
No.
Senator Metzen? Senator Sparks?
No.
Senator Stumpf?
No.
Senator Vandeveer?
There be 7 ayes and 5 noes. The bill passes. So, members, we will see you Thursday. So, like I said, we're going to start. Maybe plan on going a little bit longer. We're going to do the Senate File 1205, the dealing with the RDF. And we've got a smaller SIP bill. And then we're going to do the omnibus bill. So, with that, thank you very much, members. The meeting is adjourned.